You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky. Brands are spending more on e-commerce advertising due to projected rising online sales. If you're in charge of hiring for your business, these pivots have made your job even more challenging, especially if you have to hire for brand new roles. Thankfully, there's one place you can always count on to making hiring faster and easier: ZipRecruiter.com/murder. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent to over 100 top job boards with one click. Then, ZipRecruiter's powerful technology finds people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites these people to apply. It's no wonder that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See for yourself. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. Let ZipRecruiter take finding qualified candidates off your plate so you can focus on growing your business. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Harold Schechter, Amazon Charts best-selling author of Hell's Princess, unearths a nearly forgotten true crime of obsession and revenge, and one of the first and worst mass murders in American history. In 1927, while the majority of the township of Bath, Michigan, was celebrating a new primary school, one of the most modern in the Midwest, Andrew P. Kehoe had other plans. The local farmer and school board treasurer was educated, respected, and an accommodating neighbor and friend. But behind his ordinary demeanor was a narcissistic sadist seething with rage, resentment, and paranoia. On May 18th, he detonated a set of rigged explosives with the sole purpose of destroying the school and everyone in it. 38 children and 6 adults were murdered that morning, culminating in the deadliest school massacre in U.S. history. Maniac is Harold Schechter's gripping, definitive, exhaustively researched chronicle of a town forced to comprehend unprecedented carnage and the triggering of a human time bomb, whose act of apocalyptic violence would foreshadow the terrors of the current age. The book that we're featuring this evening is Maniac, The Bath School Disaster and the Birth of the Modern Mass Killer, with my special guest journalist and author and historian, Harold Schechter. Harold is going to connect with us very, very shortly. I just want to let people know that this book was released, Maniac, was released on March 9th, so we have the privilege of speaking to Harold Schechter, the author. And Harold Schechter is an American true crime historian and the author of some of the biggest true crime classics in history, including The Mad Sculptor, Hell's Princess, Maneater, Deranged, Depraved, Deviant, and the list goes on. More than 25 true crime books among his historic writing. He is scheduled for many interviews today, and so we are just waiting for him to call in and connect, which should be very, very shortly. This book, Maniac, is available, obviously, in Kindle, hardcover, and audiobook. And Harold Schechter is one of my favorite guests because the books that he writes and the type of writing is He is incomparable. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Harold Schechter to the program. Thank you so much for this interview, Harold Schechter.
Well, I appreciate being on again.
Thank you so much. It's always a great pleasure. As you write...
Me too. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. As a historian at American True Crime, you spend a lot of time reading old newspapers, in archives, on microfilm, and online. What book of yours were you working on when you read a July 7th, 1902, Fort Wayne Daily News issue? And what story was that, and what special interest and why?
I have to say that, you know, I've written so many books and researched so many books, you have to give me a little more of a clue, because there are so many newspapers that I come across, as you were just indicating, that I don't actually remember. Tell me what happened on that date.
Well, you were working on the Hell's Princess about Belle Gunness.
Oh, the Hell's Princess. Okay,
Yes, and so you're working on that book, and then you read about this many stories, but including the one about this Bath School disaster.
Yes, but the Bath School disaster, I guess the reason for my confusion a bit is that the Bath School disaster actually occurred 25 years after that date. It occurred in May 1927. So,
yes.
It actually wasn't while I was researching my book on Belle Gunness that I first encountered it. But before that, when I did a book called Psycho USA, Famous American Killers You Never Heard Of, which was a book, as the subtitle suggests, about crimes that were very, very sensational in their own day, often received national, even international, sometimes media coverage, but somehow lapsed into total obscurity. And it was while doing that book that I first encountered and wrote one of the entries on the Bath School disaster.
Right. Now, in preparation for this, in this introduction, you talk about several high-profile duels before this time, and also you discuss the vain principle of personal honor in some of this as well. And tell us what you found in your research, and of course, this will have some relation to this incredible story.
Well, one of the things that has did me for a long time as a historian of American crime is the whole question of why certain crimes become these big sensations and other equally and sometimes more heinous crimes, don't really get that much attention or disappear almost instantly from the news. One thing that I have discovered in my researches, reading old newspapers from various times and different places, is that you can open up any newspaper from any day and any time, any year and any place in this country and come across terrible murders that happened.
Right.
But again, only a handful, become these media sensations. So I believe what you are referring to. So in my introduction to my new book, Maniac, about the Bath School disaster, I discussed that issue. One of the conclusions I came to is that there are certain crimes that speak to issues of the moment, that are matters of widespread concern or anxiety. So the dueling thing that you referred to, one of the examples I give in the introduction to my book had to do with the subject of an earlier book of mine called Killer Cult, which was a murder committed in the 1840s, I think 1840 or 1841, by John Colt, who was the brother of the famous inventor of the revolving pistol. And that became a big, big newspaper sensation of the time. And one of the reasons for that, I speculated, was that it touched on an issue that was a matter of concern then, which was the whole practice of resolving despite dueling. So, yeah, I gave that as an example. I gave other examples that the interest, the incredible obsessive attention that was paid to the Leopold and Loeb thrill killing of 1924, really touched a nerve with a public that was very, very concerned about the moral breakdown of what they called the flaming youth of the jazz age. So it was in that context that I mentioned the dueling stuff.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to Clinton County, Michigan, in the area where this story originates, and the Kehoes. And you write about that they came from Ireland during the Great Famine of 1847. Mm-hmm. And tell us where they settled, and you talk about the father, Philip. And tell us about Philip, his father, and about the birth of Andrew and his status in that family after waiting for a son for so many years.
The Kehoes, Philip, they were kind of epitomes of what people think of as, this kind of immigrant American dream type family, as you say, came over here during the Great Famine, as millions of their countrymen did. They ultimately emigrated to Michigan, where land was cheap and plentiful. He became a very, very successful farmer and a pillar of the community. We're talking about an area of Wisconsin not too far away from what became the capital of the state, Lansing. He gave birth to a bunch of children, all of whom were girls. Andrew was the first son. So, of course, as is true, I think, in many immigrant families, he enjoyed a special status in the family, which one of the things about writing about notorious killers from the past is that until they become notorious killers, they're totally obscure, pretty much non-entities. I mean, as far as the larger world is concerned,
right?
So there's very little information that can be gleaned about their backgrounds. A lot of it is speculative. A lot of stories that begin to circulate about their pasts are told after they've committed these horrible crimes, and are colored by the knowledge of their capacity for evil, or just invented. So, we don't know a huge amount about Andrew's background. We do know that from an early age, he was very mechanically inclined and fascinated by electricity. Supposedly, and again, this is probably at least somewhat apocryphal, maybe entirely. As a child would invent these gadgets, that were presumably labor-saving farming devices.
Sure.
Yeah, but we don't know a heck of a lot about it. I mean, he did go off to college, although he doesn't seem to have graduated. He did have several jobs that related to electrical engineering. Ultimately, at a somewhat advanced age for the time, he got married to a woman from a very prominent local family and became a farmer.
You talk about his father had married, and when Andrew was 18, his mother died. It was a long progressive illness. And so Andrew remained at his father's side, assisting in the farm work, as you say, in the livestock breeding. His father had been continued with that. And then Philip took another wife. And eventually he took another wife much later. Maybe you can tell us about an event that maybe forebode the future involving this much younger stepmother and when Andrew had moved back to the farm with his father and the stepmother.
Yeah, well, again, that's one of those events that took on a very sinister cast in light of the atrocity that Kehoe ultimately was responsible for. So again, it's a little hard to know, you know, what really went happened. I mean, what we do know is that at the time, gasoline-fueled ovens were being marketed around the country as a kind of state-of-the-art cooking device that would save housewives the trouble of getting up early in the morning and, you know, starting a wood fire in their oven, you know, their wood stoves. You know, these were devices that had a little, little fuel tank above the stove, you know, which held gasoline that would be fed into the stove. So, needless to say, they were very dangerous, and there were all these stories about these horrible gas explosions and, you know, people being killed or horribly injured, and that appears, and that's what happened with Kehoe's stepmother. Now, the story that again gained circulation much, much later in the wake of Kehoe's crime, you know, is that, you know, he came to the house and saw that she was in flames, and he basically did nothing. You know, one writer claimed he just stood there and watched her burn. Again, it's very, very hard to know how much credence to, you know, to give that account.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. In retrospect, everything seems to fall in place, and there was all these signs, but obviously if there were never any of this event, we would never hear any of those obvious signs. You talk
well,
about...
again, you know, I am saying that, but I'm also saying that might not have been a sign because it actually might not have happened. In other words, his mother definitely died, his stepmother definitely died in a an explosion from a gasoline stove, but whether, you know, Kehoe just stood there and watched her burn to death, you know, that is a very open question. So.
Certainly. On May 14th, you write that 1912, 8 months after stepmother Frances's death, Andrew took a wife, and this is Ellen Agnes Price, or they called her Nellie. And her dad had served as Lansing's chief of police at one time and president of Lansing Auto Body Company. So tell us a little bit about this relationship with Nellie and the relationship that he had with the parents. What was there was some ties with the parents in terms of their home. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, Nellie came from a very prominent local family, she and Andrew again married what, as I said, for the time would have been regarded as, I mean, she would have been, I can't remember her exact age, but essentially, again, given the age we live in or they lived in, would have been regarded as an old maid pretty much. She had through her uncle, they were able to purchase when her uncle, who owned a great deal of property around the farming community of Bath, died, They were able, Andrew was able, and Nellie, to purchase from his estate a very large, flourishing farm, which is where they ultimately settled. And it was Nellie's relatives who basically owned the mortgage that Kehoe had taken out on the farm, because they, you know, they were in charge of the, they were the executors of the estate.
Right. Now, at the same time, the you write about Andrew at this time, he seemed like an unusually clever and capable and accommodating fellow that was always ready to lend a hand and ask for nothing in return, especially when he was willing to put his mechanical skills to use to benefit his neighbors.
Yes.
Now,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Yes, sorry, go ahead. Yeah, no,
now
Kehoe was known.
You talked about Kehoe becoming integrated into the community, into the social life at this time with his personality. Despite anything that people would say otherwise, he still was enjoying playing card games with other couples. But there were things that people did notice at that time, not to say that there were, you know, deal breakers not having friends, but you write that some of the things that people noticed at that time, very, very unusual. Tell us some of the things that friends noticed, you know, the card game, but also how he dressed while working in the fields.
Yeah, Kehoe would dress like a banker, really, when he went out to work. You know, obviously, all these other farmers were in coveralls and so on and so forth. And, you know, Andrew would go out in a suit. He was very, very, very meticulous, perhaps, you know, to an excessive degree. I mean, it's very possible a modern psychologist would diagnose him as OCD, you know, and it extended again to these card games that he and his wife would be part of, you know, because he was very, very rigid in terms of everybody following the rules very, very precisely and exactly. You know, so there was something very, there was something slightly tyrannical about him. Again, something very, very, very rigid. You know, people like that are often keeping, sometimes without their own knowledge, a very, very tight lid on all kinds of threatening and disruptive impulses, which in Kehoe's case sometimes broke through. I mean, again, these were stories that were told only later on. But apparently at one point he killed a neighbor's puppy who had wandered onto his property. And at another time apparently beat a recalcitrant horse to death. So, you know, underlying, you know, this very, very, you know, adherence to rigid social behavior, there were these very dark and apparently sadistic impulses.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was, you write, there was farm bureaus were popping up and forming throughout the country, cooperative organizations devoted to promoting the practical and economic interests of local farmers. And when this National Farm Bureau was founded in 1919, Andrew volunteered to head its drive for membership. And you write a couple of years later, in 1921, he was elected to the board of directors of its Bath Township unit.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about his stay in this position.
You know, again, there's only a limited amount that we know about it. Kehoe, again, in various parts of his life, did want to exert, you know, it's related to what we were just talking about before, He was, to an extent, what we would now call a control freak, and he had very strong and rigid opinions about things, and a very, very powerful sense that his way was the right way, and did not easily brook any kind of opposition, and would develop, as it turned out, you know, very, very extreme grudges against people who opposed him. So it's not exactly clear what led him to leave that post, to quit the Farm Bureau post, but it's easy enough to imagine, you know, there was something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the among the various reformist crusades of 1890 to 1920 in America, called the Progressive Era, was a movement to overhaul the badly outdated school systems in rural districts throughout the Midwest. And you talked about the difference in, you know, children going to country, in country towns, being schooled as opposed to people in the big city. So there was this reform going on. What did it manifest itself in terms of for Bath itself, and what did Andrew feel about this this move towards consolidating a school and building a new school? What did he think about this, along with others? Why were there some resistance to this?
Well, what you're referring to is this movement which occurred in regional areas throughout the country. Rural areas throughout the country, to do away with the old one-room schoolhouse system, and to replace those schools with what they can call modern consolidated schools, where the students in the community would all be educated from elementary up through high school. And, you know, part of the rationale for that was that there were a lot of farm people who felt that their children were not being educated in the way that city kids were, and that was leaving them at a disadvantage in terms of their future in a rapidly modernizing world. But there were other people in the community who opposed these consolidated schools because, you know, they were a big expense. They would be paid for by increases in their taxes. And they felt that, you know, the old little red schoolhouses were fine for them. And since they assumed that their kids were going to just grow up to be farmers or farm wives, you know, they had no need for a fancy education. So in Bath, as in many other communities across the country, there was a debate over whether they should invest in this new consolidated school, and ultimately the people who were for it prevailed. Kehoe was among the opponents, largely because he resented having additional property taxes, particularly since he and Nellie had no children. Once the school was erected and became, you know, really the pride of the community, Kehoe made sure to get himself appointed as school board treasurer, so that he could keep, tight rein on school expenditures and so on.
Mm-hmm. Who was the superintendent of this new consolidated school, and what was his character like, seemingly?
Well, the superintendent was a young man named Emery Hoik, a college graduate, and, you know, very, very devoted educator, who was determined to bring the educational standards of the new school up, you know, to as high a level as possible, which he succeeded in doing. In very short order, the school had to be accredited by the state, and under Hoik's leadership, it did so very, very quickly. But at the same time, Andrew Kehoe developed this incredible antipathy toward Hoyt, partly because he felt that Hoyt was spending money a little too freely to improve school. But also, you know, Kehoe couldn't really tolerate another man being in competition with him in any position of power. So
there was animosity. Let's use this as an opportunity just for a second.
Yeah.
Use this opportunity for a second to stop for these messages. Now, you talked about the animosity towards Emory Hoyt and Andrew Kehoe, but Andrew Kehoe is still involved in civic politics in the community, and he wants to be involved with the school board. But you write about the Great War, as you call it, and the fortunes of area farmers initially as a result of this Great War, and then the turnaround, the drastic turnaround for farmers, including Andrew Kehoe.
Right. Well, the Great War is not my own coinage. You know, of course, we now know it as World War I, but at the time it occurred, nobody knew there was going to be a World War II, so they weren't calling it World War I. It was just known as the Great War. That was one of the interesting things that I discovered in researching the book, was that, as I think I said, the Depression, you know, which we always think about as beginning with a stock market crash in 1929, happened much earlier for a lot of American farmers, because during the Great War, the years of the Great War, you know, their livelihoods were flourishing because there were very few crops that could be grown in war-torn Europe. So they were shipping all these, you know, all these crops overseas and making a lot of money, you know, a lot of them, and took loans to acquire more farming machinery and expand their property. But once the war was over and those countries recovered and got back to producing their own crops, the U.S. market plunged. And a lot of those farmers, you know, again, suffered this pre-depression. And, you know, one of them was Kehoe, was one of the reasons that his finances started to plunge so precipitously.
Mm-hmm. You talk about that he was had an assessment, and it was $12.26 per $1,000 of property valuation. In Kehoe's case, that was roughly $150 per year, or $2,300 today. And so he was very angered by this assessment, wasn't he? Especially considered his attitude, but also considering his financial situation.
Well, yeah, and again, that was the tax levied to pay for the new school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ultimately, Kehoe, you know, who is obviously undergoing this extreme psychological breakdown, you know, began to believe that if it hadn't been for those increased property taxes to pay for the school, you know, he never would have found himself in the extreme financial peril that he was in.
Yeah. Now, he has this ongoing war with Emory Hoyt, but he still believes that he can get a place on the board. And so there's another election. What happens in that election?
There were a couple of elections that, you know, he was hoping to win. And, you know, as it turned out, you know, he lost them. You know, and both were blows. You know, Kehoe suffered from a malady that is characteristic of many mass murderers, that psychologists call malignant narcissism. When he lost these elections, there were these unbearable blows to his narcissism. And of course, you know, he blamed his fellow townspeople for inflicting them.
Yeah, you talk about he the couple things that he didn't get reelected treasurer, and then he assumed a position of a woman that was had a year left, and then he thought he would be able to retain that position, but he didn't. But there was an incident where there was a swarm of bees that plagued the school, and Kehoe had volunteered to fix and fix the situation, and he got rid of the bees. Because they were impressed with this handling of the situation, what did the board authorize him, you say, unofficially to do? What did he unofficially become for the school?
Well, he became an unofficial handyman, you know, who is called, you know, throughout his life in Bath, Kehoe, you know, especially before he descended into madness, you know, was always willing to lend a hand to a neighbor to fix a mechanical problem that they had encountered. And so, yeah, he was, you know, he did have this mechanical skill and this electric skill. And, yeah, so he was authorized to become a kind of unofficial handyman, which allowed him pretty much 24/7 access to the school. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, of course, was he was able to familiarize himself with the, you know, with the structure of the school and all the inner workings of the school and, you know, the lower, you know, the basement of the school and all the nooks and crannies of the school. You know, that knowledge, of course, ended up being used for, you know, incredibly malicious purpose. But, you know, his accessibility to the school, you know, gave him all this knowledge.
Mm-hmm. You read about the Great War and the U.S. chemical industry turning out billions of tons of high explosives for the Allies in the war. But since the armistice, there was still a government with vast stockpile of surplus explosives. So the Department of Agriculture came up with a plan. What's this plan? And well, just tell us about pyrrolidone.
Well, pyrrolidone was a low-grade form of dynamite manufactured by the government and sold to farmers using all of the surplus explosives that had been manufactured for the, you know, for the armaments of the Great War that had been left over after the armistice. And farmers were allowed... every farmer was allowed to acquire, I believe, 500 pounds of this. It looked exactly like dynamite, although it had, you know, a slightly smaller amount of TNT, but it was being sold to farmers so that they could clear their fields of tree stumps and boulders and so on. And, you know, Kehoe was easily able to acquire hundreds of pounds of this, which he then supplemented by buying other sticks of dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he was stockpiling all this explosives, but, you know, again, that would raise eyebrows today. But at the time, you know, it didn't set off any alarms because, again, a lot of farmers were buying it, pyrrolidone. I mean, so many that they eventually ran out of it.
You write, though, that in fall 1925, Kehoe asked a neighbor for a ride to Jackson, nearby town, to get boxes of pyrrolidone. He got 500 pounds at that time and stored it in his barn. You also write that that Nellie's relatives that were good enough to have this mortgage, he hadn't paid this mortgage in years, and so they were getting fed up. What was their attitude, and what were they trying to do in terms of this property?
Well, I mean, they were trying to get paid. You know, at one point, for example, Nellie was supposed to come into a legacy payment of $500, but instead of sending her a check, the lawyer for the estate applied it, you know, to this growing unpaid mortgage, you know, which Kehoe was incredibly outraged by. And finally sued to get it back. You know, but Nellie's relatives you know, they were very, very forbearing. Again, Kehoe seethed with resentment over their mistreatment of him. But, you know, when you look at the facts, I mean, they were very, very tolerant of him.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also a sign,
In November, you write November. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I mean, that whole episode was just a sign of the extent to which Kehoe's financial situation, you know, was going, you know, so rapidly downhill.
You write, on November 26, he didn't have a vehicle, but after purchasing his own pickup truck, he drove to Lansing and bought two boxes of dynamite and blasting caps.
Mm-hmm.
In this book, Maniac, you include the story of Charles Lindbergh. And how he changed the course of aviation history, but also why is Charles Lindbergh an important figure, or a figure that you included in this book? What was it about Charles Lindbergh and his story?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I struggled a little bit in writing the book was exactly how to deal with the Lindbergh angle. You know, at a certain point in the book, maybe halfway through, maybe a little less, I suddenly introduce Charles Lindbergh and to go through his early life and his early experiences, a daredevil aviator and a barnstormer and an airmail carrier, and kind of leading up to where he first gets the idea that he might be able to accomplish this feat, which had become a very big thing, namely making the first nonstop solo flight across the Atlantic. And the way the book is constructed is you don't really discover why I've introduced Lindbergh until much, much later in the book. And what I am hoping that, you know, readers, when they get to that reveal, will kind of understand that the earlier stuff about Lindbergh was not some weird digression, but that there's an actual payoff, which I'm happy to discuss now, but I think would be better discussed a little later on.
Yes. Let's talk about now that they have this incident where on January 27th, there's a couple neighbors are talking, and Jobs Light and Harry Cushman, and they talked about hearing an explosion New Year's night. And so Slight bumps into Kehoe and asks him if he had set off any explosives around midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And does And what did these people think that he had set off these explosions for? What was the reason for it?
Well, I mean, they just assumed, you know, it was some kind of New Year's Eve celebration thing. You know, Kehoe admitted that you know, he said he'd fashioned a kind of a crude timing device from an alarm clock and set it to go off at 12 o'clock. So, you know, they wrote it off. Again, they knew Kehoe liked to play around with these electric and mechanical inventions of his. So they just assumed this was one of his ways of ushering in the new year.
For all the his superiority, he claimed, in agricultural practices and all his sophisticated farm equipment, nobody really knew the significance of what they saw at the time. But what did they witness in terms of the crops in the field of Andrew Kehoe?
Well, they just began to notice that, you know, for some weird reason, he had begun to neglect all his farming duties, and you know, and the farm was basically, you know, going to ruin.
Mm-hmm. One other thing you mentioned is that people had a hard time starting the cars in the 20s. So as a result, they went and purchased something. What is that device that they purchased and for the purpose of helping them get their car started?
They purchased what they would call hot shot batteries, which would help, spark the engine, as opposed to, they still often had to use hand cranks, but supplemented by these hot shot batteries, it made the process of starting the car much easier. So, Kehoe was buying dynamite. He was buying these hot shot batteries. He was fashioning detonating devices out of alarm clocks. He was doing all this. His farm was going to waste. His finances, were in tatters. His wife was increasingly being hospitalized with illness. But various neighbors noticed all these things. But none of them individually, or really even taken together, were enough to, wave any kind of red flags. They could all be explained away in, in understandable terms.
You have a person in first week of May, in the middle of the night, 2 a.m., Mrs. Hall is awakened by a sound of a motor, and she notices a Ford pickup close to the front of the steps of the school. What does she see a man doing near that school at 2 a.m.?
She sees him carrying these crates into the school, which struck her as a little unusual, particularly since she assumed that for some reason that there were crates of potatoes. She couldn't really explain to herself why anybody would be carrying bushels of potatoes into the school at 2 o'clock in the morning. And we don't exactly know what explanation she gave herself. But of course, however bizarre it seemed, she could never have expected what was, or suspected what was going on.
You write also in sometime in early May, Frank Smith, the janitor, noticed a trap door gaining access to the crawl space beneath a new part of the building had been left open. And he'd been working down there repairing a leak. He just thought he had forgotten. But a week later, he saw it open again. Why did he not? What was there no concern for him? Why did he think this was not something that he of concern to him?
He just assumed. He specifically assumed for some reason Emery Hoik, the superintendent, who's one of whose concerns was the maintenance of the building, had gone down there. Mm-hmm. Again, coming across an open trap door, would not necessarily be cause for any great alarm. It's easy to imagine that he just assumed he forgot to close it a couple of times. Or again, just assume that somebody with a perfectly legitimate reason for going down there, like Emery Hoik, had gone down there. One of the interesting aspects of cases like this is, in retrospect, things seem it's like, why didn't I see that? Why didn't I notice that? But at the time, again, Kehoe buying dynamite, the fact that they had dynamite for sale at this hardware store, a sign that people are buying dynamite. The fact that he sets them off at midnight, New Year's Eve, that's just Andrew, showing off his ability to, create a little timer out of an alarm clock. You know, if somebody's carrying some crates into the school at night, that's a little odd, but, you know, got to be some explanation, so.
Yeah, nothing put together. You talked about Nellie being released from the hospital in early May, and she had gone to her sister Elizabeth to recuperate in Lansing. And it was a two-week stay. On May 16th, after it was a storm, he finally fetched her. But the very next evening, Elizabeth called to check on her sister.
Yeah.
What did there was no answer, but what did – and Andrew called shortly after. What did Andrew say about his about Elizabeth's sister?
He explained that she was going over to visit some friends whose name was Vost, V-O-S-T, and that he was going to go be picking her up soon. Her Nellie's sisters had never heard, were unaware that she had had friends named Vost. But again, you know, they didn't attach any particular significance to it.
Mm-hmm. Now let's get to, there was a bunch of precipitating events. And again, in retrospect, people, you know now the significance of some of the things that he said. There was a school teacher that had called Andrew and said, we'd like to come to your grove on your property for a little picnic with the children. And he, because of this May 19th, he said, well, you best not come on May 19th. I think you better come on May 17th and get it done as soon as you can. So there was events like that. So now the day of May 17th, take us to that day and Andrew Kehoe and the school itself. And he has a friend named Derluff. And so please take us to that day and the events of the early morning and what happens at the Bath School that morning. And also, in preparation, you talk about this is the graduation day. Not all of the students are taking the exams, but you can tell us how many people were in that school and the situation in terms of HOIC and the exams themselves.
Well, it was the last day of school, May 18th, 1927. It was a day that Kehoe knew that pretty much all the students would be assembled in the school. Kehoe had run into another school board member named Detloff, who had been asked to come over to the school to take a look at who had an auto repair. He was a blacksmith, but you know, with the advent of Ford's Model T, had become an auto mechanic. Was asked to come over to the school to take a look at some problem with a water pump in the basement. He ran into Kehoe on the way, you know, seemed a little weirdly nervous and asked Kehoe if he wanted to come along. You know, he knew Kehoe's mechanical skill. Kehoe seemed reluctant to do it and prompt, you know, very soon disappeared from the scene. In the book, you know, based on various firsthand accounts that I was able to get hold of, I tried to recreate the events of the day from various points of view. You know, the students assembled. Some of the students were in their classrooms having stories read to them, you know, in the lower grades by their teachers. Other students were taking their final exams. Students had been exempted from the final exams because of their superior grades. But you know, some were out in the schoolyard. There were some older boys, you know, chucking around a baseball. You know, it was just kind of a what seemed to be a nice, idyllic last day of school. You know, then at 9:30 exactly, the explosion happened. Kehoe, as it ultimately emerged, the man who had been supposedly carrying crates of potatoes into the school was Andrew Kehoe, and he wasn't carrying crates of potato. He had been carrying boxes of dynamite. He'd spent weeks rigging the basement of the school with all of the dynamite and pyrrhotol that he had purchased, several hundred pounds of it. He had made these crude timing devices and set them to go off at 9:30 in the morning on the last day of school when he felt sure he would be able to kill as many children as possible. At 9:30, the detonators went off, but fortunately, nobody knows exactly why, but there was apparently some faulty wiring or a short circuit. Much of the explosives did not detonate. If everything that Kehoe had planted there had gone off, he would have essentially wiped out an entire generation of school children in that community,
right.
Of children. But one entire wing of the school did explode, and of course, Detloff and other parents who had kids in the schools, immediately ran frantically to the scene, and were confronted with this sight of horrific devastation. I say in my book, it looked like, you see pictures of it, it looks like, one of these devastated European towns that had been destroyed by artillery. Just piles and piles of rubble with dead and dying and shrieking children buried inside of it. And everybody started frantically, trying to dig through the rubble. Meanwhile, Kehoe, who was at his farm at the time the explosion went off, had loaded up his Ford pickup truck with more explosives and shrapnel,
mm-hmm.
and drove down to the school and called Emery Hoik, his nemesis, and a couple of other people over to the truck. Exactly what happened then is not known. Different eyewitnesses gave slightly different accounts, but whether he had a rifle that he fired into the truck or pulled some kind of switch, whatever, he detonated his truck and killed himself, killed Hoik, killed a couple, some other bystanders. The thing about the Bath School disaster is that, it turned out to be the deadliest school massacre, again, in U.S. history, and, the worst case of domestic terrorism before Timothy McVeigh, and, the first and only suicide car bombing, discounting, the recent one in Nashville, which didn't claim any victims except, the guy who set it off. So, it was this unprecedented, horrific crime.
Yeah. They also found eventually Nelly lashed to a hog cart and burned
yes.
alive or set on fire. And so that
yeah.
was solved that mystery. You say that this story, again, we'll introduce Charles Lindbergh. Why was this story not, it made national news, you say, for a week. It had that phenomenon of the week attention. But
yeah.
tell us about Charles Lindbergh and that story and what happened to the Bath school disaster story for years.
Yeah, well, it wasn't even a week. So, yes, immediately with the Bath school disaster was an enormous nationwide front page story. In fact, it even made international headlines. Adolf Hitler sent a letter of condolence to Franklin Roosevelt, the president,
mm-hmm.
expressing his condolences. But 3 days later, Lindbergh completed his world-changing solo flight across the Atlantic, which at the time was as momentous an event as the moon landing 40 years later. And yeah, it completely displaced every other news story from the papers. I mean, the day after the Bath School disaster, the disaster was the lead story on the front page of the New York Times. 3 days later, the New York Times devoted the entirety of its first 5 pages to Lindbergh and his flight, and all other news was either relegated to the back pages or completely omitted, including the Bath School disaster. So that was one major reason why this horrific crime was so completely relegated to obscurity.
Now, you talk about since 1999 and Columbine, mm-hmm, that all kinds of other future school shootings that journalists rediscovered, and the story resurfaced about Bath School Massacre in reference to these school shootings, the horrific school shootings. So the story did come back into public awareness, didn't it?
Well, to some extent. I mean, you know, if you ask most people about the Bath School Massacre, they will look at you kind of blankly, I think. I mean, I've spoken to a lot of people who grew up in Michigan who never even heard of it. So, but yes, you're right. I mean, every time in the recent past, one of these horrific school shootings occurs, or virtually every time, newspapers will very commonly run stories about the worst school massacres in U.S. history, ranking them, of course, by number of victims. And the Bath School Massacre, which claimed the lives of 38 school children and 6 adults, ultimately, is always listed as number one. But again, it hasn't really managed to restore the story of Kehoe and the Bath School disaster to the position that I, think it holds in the annals of crimes. As I think I might have said, all through the 20th century, there were all these crimes of the century, Leopold and Loeb and the Lindbergh kidnapping, up through OJ. And by the time I finished the book, I'd really come to believe, and I still believe, that the Bath School disaster is the single worst American crime of the 20th century.
Absolutely. And thanks to you, now we have the official story of Maniac, the Bath School disaster, and the birth of the modern mass killer, which you say has replaced the ever popular serial killer now in the public's imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about if you have a website or a Facebook page for people to take a look at this book before I let you go.
There is a website, haroldschechter.com. There is a Facebook page. I have to say, somewhat embarrassedly, I myself never go on it, but it is maintained for me. And anybody who needs to contact me, I do receive messages I get on that page, and I'm always careful to answer them. Those are two spots for sure.
Great. Thank you very much, Harold, for Maniac, the Bath School Disaster, and the Birth of the Modern Mass Killer. Thank you so much for this interview, Harold Schechter. Nice speaking with you. Have a great night.
Thank you. Good speaking with you.
Good night.
Take care.